here with Ian Rayburn, the winner of Best Film at the Hellbound Horror Fest. How are you doing, Ian?
I'm doing really great, man. Thank you for having me, and thanks again for all the incredibly hard work you put in and making a genre film festival for us genre filmmakers. And the love is felt. So thank you for doing all that. It was a real pleasure and honor to be a part of it and to win. Thank you.
That was, it was a few years in the making, because of the first festival, as you know. I don't think you were part of it officially in terms of submission last time, 2020.
I didn't have a horror. I was so busy, and it was like, because I wanted to submit, and it was a horror festival too. And I love making horror projects. I thought, oh, amazing. And I don't know, you know, if it was my classic mix of just scatterbrain, being genuinely busy with other things, and then having, you know, lack of motivation, or, you know, maybe a depressive state or whatever that just like held me back from doing anything. I don't even know, but I remember that whole submission time. I was like, fuck, like I don't have anything. Like, I don't have any ideas. Yeah. What's wrong with you? It's right there. Like,
you didn't want to force it, man. We did have some good judges that year.
I know. It's awesome. I watched the whole thing. I loved it.
Yeah. It was 2020 is kind of how we met with the Isolation Film Festival with Days, and that was a great still a fantastic show. And
thanks, man.
You know, we've got a very strong mutual love of Black Magic, everything Black Magic in terms of the camera, not actual Black Magic. Isolation Film Festival.
We'll get into that later.
Oh no, absolutely, yeah. I wanted to kind of talk to you about Blue Devil and working on Star Trek, all sorts of stuff, your love for horror.
I love horror, yeah, absolutely.
And so yeah, it's been what, 3 years since we last spoke? 3 years or two and a half?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably close, two and a half.
Yeah.
It's so crazy because like before the pandemic, saying like, when was that? 2 years ago was so much easier, you know? Yeah. Because 2 years before the pandemic, at least for me, you know, I did a lot more, and then the pandemic hit, you know, and then 3 years sort of just evaporated. And so it's tough to, you know, like
talk to
people with kids and they're like, oh yeah, my kid's like four. And you're like, I didn't even know you had a child.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. The whole, like, cause we spoke during pandemic and we were making good out of it. And we have both been very creative in many ways. Like a lot of people were with the Isolation Film Festival and with the Hellbound Horror Festival. I was using it as a distraction, like trying to get my head out of that, because
absolutely.
And the first thing I thought was, I'm gonna lose my job, I'm gonna lose my house, the world's gonna burn, I'm gonna die. And then after the Hellbound Horror Festival, I nearly died because it was two festivals, and then I had exhaustion, and then I got COVID.
Was bad,
I'll tell you where I know I got it from. I'll tell you outside of this, but it was, that was fucking insane. I was insane. Yeah. And I was like, I get so fucking emotional when I'm like on a plane, when I know I'm going to, you know, think I'm going to die.
Of course, man.
I was just such a fucking wreck. And then,
And yours was bad. Like when I got COVID I got it April 2020. And, I mean,
you got it early on.
Yeah. No vaccines or anything. And so sort of in the lot of, we don't know what's going on, at least for myself phase. Yeah. And there was a lot of fear and anxiety around what's going to happen. And then I was told by someone that they had it, and it was, you know, from the entertainment industry, and, you know, cause we were still working. I was like, well, I don't feel anything. Got tested. Was positive. I mean, I had a more severe headache than I'm usually used to, you know. Every now and then I'll get like a stress headache, or if I'm on the computer for too long, which happens more often. This though was like, oh, this is a little bit, for like half a day and that's it.
And so
every day I was like, am I gonna turn this day? I'm asthmatic. Am I gonna go, you know, have to go to the hospital, because I had no idea. Am I going to get pneumonia?
That's what I had. I had like,
that's what I mean. Yeah, absolutely. Pneumonia. And I, so there was a, yeah. it, it, it was a really anxiety ridden time for me. And then now, and because I'm like getting excited, just, you know, chatting with you and that, I don't even know if you can hear it and I'm not going to do it, but like 6 months after having COVID, I have asthma like I do when I was a child again. Yeah.
Wow. That's your long COVID, isn't it?
That's the long haul. Yeah. I didn't realize it, you know, like I would be with, you know, my friends and they would genuinely make me laugh, you know, that genuine laugh would send me into like an asthmatic fit.
Wow.
It's crazy. Just from like a heavy laugh, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like not a smoker.
My long-term effects were, I'm overweight. You can't see it from this. I frame it like late Brando.
You know, okay, I mean? Like a true professional.
Yeah, like a fucking pro, yeah. but like I can work all fucking day on a production, literally a live stream all day.
Yeah.
And on the live mix, on a camera in front of 1,000 people in a cathedral, that's what I've been doing recently. Won't be tired. If I go up 2 flights of stairs, I'm done. I'm absolutely done. That's my like long-term, like fuck's sake. I don't need that. So I need to think about my long-term health. So
absolutely. Well, you're still young, man. You got lots, you know,
a few years left.
Got lots to do. We haven't even met in person yet.
But we will, man. Maybe I know. We've got a plan now.
I 100% look forward to traveling more, you know, and back in the day, like, and I used to like, we talked a little bit and about wrestling and I love wrestling so much. And I was a wrestler and I was making my movie about it and then fucking COVID, you know? And so we're still on hiatus with some progress being happened, which is great actually. But
all right, great.
Like, well, that's just like, I know we can talk about that later on too, but
definitely.
Anyways, the whole, I guess just to say the whole pandemic thing, I'm glad that we ended up being able to be creative and work.
Totally agree. Yeah.
Personally, I had like a crisis 2 weeks into it. I was like, well, my career's over. I'm never going to be able to do anything again. This is all, all done now.
Yeah. And then we won't go too much into this because it just gets too not political, but with what happened in Ukraine recently, like everyone in Europe just thinks, yeah, that's the end of everything. And my head goes there for longer than it needs to.
Sure. Of course.
You know, so, and I do have PTSD from being in hospital as well. So that is going to feed into my creativity.
I was just going to say, how does that manifest?
Oh, it will, like, seeing people die in my ward that I'd spoken to for a week. It's fucking nuts, man. I'm going to do possibly a TEDx talk next year.
Really?
Because, you know, the locally ones that are
absolutely.
So I'm thinking about doing it, but I need to be in the right place for it.
Sure. Yeah. Wow.
I should have had therapy after I left hospital. That's how I felt about it. So.
Yes. Oh, big component of therapy and.
Yeah. Fucking hell. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons we'll move beautifully onto your, your best film and best performance award, the Orlok Award for best acting for your film Blue Devil. I want to know. I honestly, my wife will kill me if I don't ask the right questions and that.
Sure. No, anything you want.
So, how did it start? What was the kind of, what are your influences for it? And yeah, there's production questions we'll ask later, you know, very specific technical stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, kind of, when, how did it start and all that?
Well, the real sort of idea, it was not really an idea that I had beforehand. You know, a lot of times I'll get an idea and it'll go in my notes or I'll write it in a little journal that I have and it'll just be, you know, like I remember Quentin Tarantino saying he would just listen to music and then sort of daydream and the music would just be scoring the scene in his head and he would just like write that scene down. And sometimes he would write, you know, Inside Out, that would be the start, this scene that he already has to music, and then he would expand out. And I definitely was doing that before I heard him talk about it, but I was like, oh, okay, good. This is like what real professional creatives do. Okay, that must mean that's a good sign. But so I usually have a lot of moments. I did not for Blue Devil. I had been asked by my brother and his family months before if I wanted to go to his house and house sit and dog sit. They have a beautiful little miniature schnauzer, Alfie.
Oh my God, and, the dog.
Yeah, I was like, no problem. And then that was months earlier, you know, and I just didn't forget about it, but just didn't think about it. And then just had some mental health moments, you know, that were sort of peppered in leading up to that. Yeah. And I was not really in a great space emotionally, sort of going into that. And I was really negative about it, you know, like, oh, I'm going to be away from my own place. I needed a change of scenery, and I'm going to be losing work. And what am I going to do for a week? And now I love animals. So I thought, well, at least I will have this adorable dog who I know likes me. And there is something, you know, healing about animals and having that. But I was just really negative about the whole process and really down on myself. And, you know, very much like the COVID pandemic, right at the beginning, when I realized that this is not going to stop anytime soon, you know, I just had this, well, what am I going to do? What's, you know, this crisis, you know? And I remember the first day that I stayed there, I was just like, what am I going to do for like the next, I didn't really have a lot of work to do. I brought my computer, you know, and I just was like, I'm not inspired or motivated right now. And I have no idea. So the first 2 days that I was there was sort of, I would look after the dog. I would walk. I would do a little bit of work and email, and then nothing. And at the end of the second night, I was like, I don't want to do this every single day. And maybe the weekend that was coming up, I had some friends in town. Maybe I would invite them over and try and do something social, because I can't just like sit here and wasting it. And that sort of just transitioned me into, well, then just write, not to film anything, but just to write as a creative. I thought, oh, you know, and because you're in a completely different environment, so my like regular routines of watching movies or even going on my phone or whatever was completely different. Plus you have a dog and he likes to cuddle and likes to play and wants to go out, so that interrupts you, as you know, which is a great thing. So I thought, I'll just write. I had been thinking, a good friend of mine is writing a book. And, you know, we've talked about it a lot and sort of incorporating just personal stuff in there and in general in work, you know, a big reason of why I, outside of my love of horror, a big reason why I sort of wanted to make horror specifically, A, I enjoy it, practical effects, the violence, the gore, you know, but also because there was a part of me that was so insecure about actually making meaningful things or having a voice to say, that I didn't believe in myself enough to do that. So I thought, well, at least if I'm doing horror, which I love, if I do the most shocking things, then that's all people will need to remember. You know, if the story sucks and the acting sucks, at least they can be like, oh, well, the blood was cool. And so it was sort of a crutch for me emotionally, because I was too afraid to do something honest or to say something, my actual opinion perhaps. So yeah. I just was writing that night, and I had that really in my mind, because I definitely put pieces of that in stuff that I've doing, especially as I've grown as a filmmaker. I think definitely you know, I've put some bits and pieces in there, but this I sort of was a horror idea, but with a bit of personality, of sort of truth of where I was at and what I was feeling literally in that moment. And because I was staying at my brother's house, and he just has this like fucking amazing, huge, detached old house that just is great for haunted house movies. Yeah. Like, it just looks so cinematic. And so then I just used that as the space. And then I wrote it very quickly with no dialogue. As I was writing it,
a treatment first?
I just was like a short script. It was like 8 pages.
Yeah.
because I didn't even write full dialogue scenes. There was no tension building. I write a lot of camera technique in my scripts, also as just a reminder for myself, because I have, you know, if it's a one-man crew or if it's a smaller crew, it's just easier, or if it's a extensive VFX or prop scene, I'll just literally write it in, so at least the person reading it who's going to do it can be like, oh, I didn't do any of that with this. So sometimes my scripts are like double the length they need to be because of all the exposition.
That makes
sense. So this was pretty short. And then the next morning I woke up and I read it and I was like, oh, maybe I should just film this to keep me busy. Honest to goodness, I didn't think I was going to make a film, make something to submit to festivals. And so it was like that afternoon I sort of planned, okay, I can do these opening shots with me at the dog park that I'm going to take the dog to anyways. And, you know, I want to put him in it because he's just so cute. And I love, you know, and you'd seen a lot of the recent work that I've done. And through COVID, you know, I just filmed a lot in this apartment. I filmed like everything in this apartment.
Yeah.
And it really limited me because I sort of got used to the design and the layout of here. That when I got to my brother's house and I was just doing camera tests, I was like, oh, wow, depth. An actual full hallway with room for, you know, practical backlights that, you know, because there's depth. And that was crazy. And we can talk more about the technical stuff later. But then I just sort of started shooting these scenes and then just sort of improvising with an idea in my head of what the edit might be. And then I would edit that night, short of going in sequence. And then when it got to a lot of the nighttime stuff, it was just do my thing in the day. And a big technical thing that I will say just now that I don't do ever on any films is I shot most of the whole movie on a 16mm lens, which I never shoot.
Oh wow. Was it like a Rokinon or something?
I have the Rokinon, the Cine lens, the 16 mil, because I literally did everything by myself.
Was that almost for safety?
It was because I could have the monitor facing me while I was on camera, and I could be close enough to it that I could focus on, and I could know for sure that I was in focus, because I'm, you know, if I put a 35 or a 50 on, I can't. The close-up would be too close if I was trying to get focused. Yeah. So it was also a technical shortcoming. It was like, and I want to make sure that, so almost everything, so there's a lot of, and a lot of people when they saw it, but you know, when I made it and I sent it to some of my friends, were like, wow, this is different than everything. And I think it was because a lot of my stuff is close-ups and mediums, and this was, you know, a lot of full body shots. And
it did feel when because there was about 20 people that saw they were doing the judging.
Wild too, man.
Just a bunch of people we saw, and then
wild.
Before everyone sees it, my wife and I, we kind of watched everything, and then we kind of privately showed it all the films. All the official selections out. But when I watched it, I knew this was kind of not fresh, but I understood where this was coming from. Like we talked about earlier, I understood that this is way more kind of felt way more personal.
Yeah.
And through the performance, through the scene with your mom, for example, it just felt so kind of on it. And I was like, this is like Ian's next step.
Yeah. Well,
I really believe that, man. Yeah,
I really appreciate that.
That's why it works so well, because not because it's your next step, but it was like, Ian's kind of stepped above where a lot of people would be really happy with creating stuff that you've created for the last few years.
Sure.
But then I think because of those, not necessarily because of those technical shortcomings or like with the 60mm lens, but how much kind of personal kind of, part of your souls in the film.
Yeah.
So it was, that's why it did so well.
Cool. The resin. Yeah. It's nice. Thank you so much for saying, and the scene with my mom too. Everybody loves it. It's so funny to me.
And like, how did that, is that,
it's real. We did.
Was that the, yeah, that was,
no, she's amazing. Not a, we, I, well, basically I was in a just a shit poor mood, and I picked a day that I was feeling sort of the worst, and then I set up everything to film me, and I screen recorded her and called her, and we chatted for like 40 minutes legit, and then I just edited it together. So it's all real. Like, she had no idea. When you told me that I got into the festival is when I told my mom, hey, like, I got into this festival and I don't know what will happen, but you're also like in the movie. And then I sent it to her, and she was, and God bless my mom. She's so amazing. And she just knows that's just what I do. She was just like, oh, it was heartbreaking. I mean, she had a lot of things to say about it, but she had no problems with being in it.
She had, I thought, did Ian write this or did your mom say it about, oh, I'm only in your pocket?
Oh, man. And that's,
you know, you know how much that hit my wife?
Wow.
That was a real moment, you know, because that's why we were unsure if that was real or not.
Yeah, no, that's,
it worked, though, you know,
100% real. That was a caring mother genuinely concerned for her child.
Yeah.
And that line particularly. And also, like, I don't feel like I was exploiting my mom. I was in such a depressive state while still being like a professional filmmaker that I was like, well, I don't want to even have to direct my mom. I just have no interest really. So yeah. I'll just call. Did you ever see, as a quick aside, did you ever see, this school shooting movie called The Dirties?
No, the only one I've seen is the Gus Van Sant one, Elephant.
Oh, Elephant?
Yeah.
So these Canadian filmmakers, I heard about it on Kevin Smith's podcast years ago. Actually, my friend suggested it to me. And they sort of made this found footage style school shooting movie. And I really think it's amazing and really delves into the character of the of people, of why they do it, you know?
Yeah.
And their whole thing is they filmed a lot where they faked it as a documentary and got real performances from people. And so the lead character in the movie's mom is played by his real mom. And every time he filmed her, they just set up cameras and he wore a lav. And he would say certain things to get her to be like, no, you know, like, Alex, why would you say that?
Yeah.
You know, to get her so they could edit it into the movie. It was like quite ingenious. And so I think I was also thinking that, like,
yeah,
I'll just, and I didn't realize again, because none of this, I thought, oh man, like, yeah, that was great. Like, this is going to be such a great scene. Cause I just really didn't think that this was going to be a big narrative project. I had no idea. And then, I mean, the fact that I sort of had in my head near the end of the week, I was going to finish this just so I could submit it to the Hellbound Horror Festival like that. And it was just sort of like a goal that was just holding me on to staying busy, you know?
Okay.
So, I mean, the fact that your festival rules were 15 minutes or less also how this movie was made, because then I was like, okay, well, it needs to be less than 15. I think with the credits and everything, it was
exactly 15 minutes.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So that was another part that sort of shaped the film, because there was a lot I cut out. There's basically conversations with every character that I was just filming. And
you know why the credits are so important for this? You probably realize this through your edit anyway. Is because you're processing it. And the use of music is fantastic in this. I want to ask you about that in a minute.
Yeah, sure.
But it helps you process and, wow, this is what it's really about.
Yeah.
About the mental health of this character.
Yeah.
And the different stages this person's in.
Yeah.
And, yeah, how did you... And we'll go back and forth on this.
Sure, yeah.
So how did you get to the point of use... Where did the music come from in terms of... I know some of it's licensed online... the score and the music you chose at the end of the film, where did you kind of, what was your kind of, is basically, is it a mood thing? What suited it or?
Yeah, it was 100% mood. Again, because I really wasn't approaching this is a movie, a creative thing that I'm going to be making for people to see, even though I did the goal was to finish it so I could submit it to your festival, I was even still like, well, who, I don't, I'm not trying to be super negative against myself, but all like, who's even, excuse me, going to watch it, or it won't get selected, or I just wasn't even approaching this like, you know, like, here's a thing that I wrote and I want to shoot this. I want to make it for people to see. This was just sort of therapy, you know, in a way. So that bled into every part of it. So even in the editing process, and music is such a huge component to me and as a creator and just yeah. as a fan, you know, in any genre of film, like the music is so imperative. And so with this, it was all mood. It was all how I felt and how the scenes made me feel. The opening theme was just built with a bunch of sort of drones and tones, and I, you know, you slow it down and you pitch them up and then slow them down and speed them up and then pitch it down. And
it's fun. It's like alchemy, really, isn't it, when you do that?
Yeah there's, I'm, you know, I remember seeing on a YouTube video years ago, and it was like, slow down this Justin Bieber song, you know, 300%, and whoa, this like demon thing. And I was like, yeah. So I do that all the time. I'll take like a sound effect or something, you know, and then just slow it down. And what does that sound like? Oh, wild, you know, okay, yeah. great. And reversing stuff. And then the Christmas song in the middle, which I mean, I love Christmas. I'm born on Christmas Day. So it's like always just a thing. There's a thing in my life that I really like.
So is my dog.
Oh, really? Sick, really?
Yeah.
I'm really excited by that. Awesome. That's awesome.
I can see some Photoshop. Remember that Photoshop you did of me? My face on a dog. I can see that coming up at some point. I'm going to do it with you, my dog.
I would love to do that. You and the dog. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's so funny. So in my life,
and that was a great moment. I'm going to say that's a great like moment to choose, because there's no time worse. Because the whole idea was that it was at Christmas, right?
No, it was like in.
Oh, I thought. So I thought basically where my head went, you know, when you look at a piece of art and you can.
Yeah.
So when I heard that in the film, I thought that's the worst time to be for someone to be alone.
It's amazing. Again, I love it so much. Like people's interpretation. It's so incredible to hear. So, I mean, no, I was just like, this is like Canadian summer and, right. You know, but people are like, oh, you know, my one friend was like, oh, I really like the contrast there where you use like something completely unexpected, you know, why would Christmas music be playing? And yeah. I didn't do it technically or thematically. It literally was okay. Because my brother had this old radio.
Great prop.
Great. It's just, and it works. And I was like, I know I want to use this as a piece in this, you know, sort of haunted house, turned, you know, dramatic project, however you want to say it. And three times in my life did I have it where on the radio I was playing something completely different. Two of the times it was the jazz station, and another time it was just radio playing, all January onward into March, I believe. So after Christmas. So in three times in my life was I there post Christmas where the radio was playing and then it glitched and Christmas music started playing.
Wow.
And then went back. The first time was in the hospice after my dad passed away in January of 2007. And the radio was on. He loved jazz. And then it glitched to Christmas music. I heard it. Everybody heard it, but we didn't say anything because it was the second time I was in a vehicle with my mom and her best friend. And we were all driving. And it happened again on the radio station. And we all said, that happened, right? We just heard that. That's weird. Why would it play Christmas music? And then the third time I saw a medium and just because I was curious and before anything even started, she was such a character too. It was so interesting. Yeah. her Alexa spoke up and was like, I'm sorry, can't play Christmas, and started spouting out Christmas stuff. And she was like, Alexa, stop. And then she looked at me and she was like, does that mean something to you? And then I was like, do you know who I am? Like, do you know? And then I'm thinking, I'm going, do you know I love Christmas? Like, what the fuck is going on? So it happened three different times. You know, one time at a very traumatic moment, you know? And so it was just, I was like a no-brainer. I was like, I'm going to just put a Christmas song in here because, again, that was what really happened.
Yeah.
Then people would see it and they would, you know, have an interpretation like you had, which is amazing. Or they would just like the juxtaposition of it's sunny weather and then Christmas music's playing. Also, a lot of people really hate Christmas music. I don't at all.
I like this month, starting at end of October.
Yeah.
I've switched into fucking Santa now.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. I've gone full Santa. Like,
yeah, you'd be a great Santa.
The neighbor down the road, at number one, he's got this Santa beard going on. I've never seen him.
Oh, really?
I've never seen him walk down the street. I'm like, where the fuck did this beard come from? In a week, I saw him a week earlier. He had no beard.
Is it real?
It's real. It's white. It's,
really?
So yeah, it's another way to kind of interpret that is, it's as though your kind of strongest self is trying to break through.
I mean,
you know what I mean? So
absolutely. Yeah. There was a lot. I mean, you know, some of the stuff, same with when I did, thanks again for talking about it. When I did an earlier short, my friend Wally, and it was sort of, the same thing. I just made it, you know, I had more of an idea of stuff I wanted to do, but you know, still based around, you know, loners and isolation and wanting, you know, and then when people talk to me about it after they watch it, they had such interesting interpretations that I didn't even think about it. And I was like, I think you're right. So then it was like, I was interpreting something that I made in like a completely different way after it was made, you know, watching it, being like, I think he made it because of that.
Yeah.
I
was like, oh, I'm the That's one probably the it. Most disgusting thing you've made, because it's got all that shit. You know what I mean? So that's the closest I've been disgusted to
literal shit, not because it was shit. There was some fake poop in it.
Oh my, on the toilet seat and all. Oh my god.
Yeah.
It was like a shit weasel, like from Dreamcatcher, the Stephen King book. I'm like, fucking hell. That was like, what? Yeah. Oh my god, it's grim.
Fake poop, you know? Oh, who doesn't have fake poop on their
computer? I've been picking up so much real poop recently. My dogs, everyone. But it's, I honestly think it's your best film, because you put your heart in the sleeve with this.
And it was cool. Of course, it gives me, you know, and I really appreciate that. And, you know, we're friends, and I can say, honestly, it gives me, you know, like, slight anxiety to hear that, because then I go, well, but what did I do then? How do I do it again? You know,
the worst thing you can do is chase that.
100%. No, that's what I'm realizing, you know, it's like everything will be different, and what a beauty, you know, I have a style, you have a style, we've established that. It's not like I'm searching for, you know, how am I going to do, even when I, you know, make a film, you know, by myself, not knowing I'm really making a film. Yeah. I still, you know, you still have an idea of what we're doing and
so when you were looking at the dailies, and because you're shooting on a 16 mil lens, and I understand why, did you have like not an epiphany but something close to that about, I'm gonna start using this a little bit more now, I'm gonna start shooting slightly wider?
I just, like, especially when I started editing sequences together, and I was like, wow, yeah, you can just let it play out and have the character come outside and experience and then go down the stairs and look and then walk by the camera, and you don't even have to move the camera. And that's really compelling. And it's just one shot. I was like, wow, yeah. Like, you can see his legs in this shot. You know what I mean? After I had saw it, I was like, I need to incorporate more of this into what I'm already doing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I love
it's like what you've done is you're looking at the center of the jigsaw, and everything you see makes a picture.
Yeah.
But now you've fully seen what can be achieved. You've seen the edges of the frame, see the edges of the picture. So I think this is going to be like, it's such a positive step for your kind of cinematography at the very least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it has been. Yeah. Even just shooting whatever family B-roll and stuff like that, you know, it's just something. And I wonder too, you know, really talking about, you know, like limiting beliefs. And then I wonder if it was even a very weirdly tied up way that, you know, I would do close-ups because it was easier to draw the attention. And, you know, I really need to show you what I want you to see because I'm afraid or not confident that you'll get it in the wide, or I need this trip. Who knows? Like, sometimes I don't sit there and go that deep about myself, but, you know, even technically, you know, I never shot like that before. And it was fascinating to see, you know, how I didn't need to rely on any of my tricks or editing tricks or VFX tricks. You know, it's just like, oh, you can just literally let this play out. And because I'm shooting on a 6K camera, you know, I have a bit of flexibility to crop. I can even still do pans and zoom ins on this ultra wide shot as well.
Like that twisted, you know, the shot in the...
Absolutely.
I love that.
In the house, like, and then, yeah, love that. It's a... That's just sitting on the tripod, right?
How did you come up with... Obviously, people have seen the film, so I'm going to give spoiler territory.
I don't mind.
Well, that's good. How did you kind of come up with the three different versions of Bradley? Is it Bradley, isn't it?
Bradley, yeah.
Obviously, that's in your writing process, isn't it?
Sort of. So the and it was like, I called him like religious Bradley because he was so much more religious in the 4 or 5 minutes that I just didn't include.
The one, the glasses, the one that...
That was the glasses one. So
he held himself, that the fact that you say he's very religious, it makes much sense when you look at it.
Okay. I mean, I literally was quoting scripture as well. And I just was like, it because of the edit and because of the time sort of guideline I had, I was like, well, what do I want this story to be then in this time limit? So it can't be, I don't need any of that. So I learned all these like scriptures, whatever. It was just fun and, you know, delivering it.
Yeah.
But how did I come up with them? Well, again, I was just like feeling like shit emotionally, so I was just like, I didn't shave, I was like, literally, I was just like, so that was the regular, you know. And then I thought, okay, well, I can use the one blade on my razor and just clean up the beard and then wear my glasses and just comb my hair, and that'll be different enough because you know. And then I thought, well, maybe I can do another one as well. The last one wasn't, that was just like, maybe I'll, because I wanted to go to a barber and get a hot shave, but just leave the mustache, so I would look even different. And I've done that for a lot of projects where I just like grew a stash for it. It's funny, whatever. And all the barbers around there were booked, and I just then felt defeated. So I was like, well, then I'm not going to do that. Then when I went to shave it off, I just shaved the candle bar, and I thought it looked funny. So then I just put on a dress shirt that I brought with me in case I had an audition for a businessman or something, wore that. And that's how the third one. So again, it wasn't really this emotional thing. The core story was sort of regular depressed Bradley, and then meeting this other version of Bradley that was living this completely different life and was happy and had a family and had his parents. And then in depressed Bradley's life, he doesn't have a good relationship with his family. His father was passed away. There was this whole side storyline where the religious Bradley is like lecturing him about how he doesn't have time for this. And his family had to go to his dad's house because of, you know, whatever was happening. And then he's, you know, depressed Bradley was talking like, you have a dad. Can I see a picture of your dad? And he's like, what are you talking about? And he shows him a picture of his dad, and it's deceased Bradley's dad, but older. He didn't die in this alternate world or whatever. And so it was this whole dramatic thing where then depressed Bradley, it's like, he like freaks out, but then has this like moment where it's like, I actually needed to see that. Thank you. And that angers the press badly and turns him into a demon. It was like, that was the whole sort of storyline. And I didn't have any room for any of that.
Yeah.
So I was like, it's all got to go. Cause you know, and I was milking it as an actor. Let me tell you. And when you're acting, you know, when you're acting with yourself, it was like, I'd half remember both dialogue. And when I was filming the one take, I would just yell it out. And then I had another half recorded.
How did that work when you were sat in the chair tied up?
Yeah.
How did that work? Did you recite the other dialogue?
So I knew that because of the makeup, literally I'm doing it backwards. I had to do all depressed Bradley stuff first. Including what happens to him at the end, I won't spoil that, whatever. But if I knew this was going to be a movie, and people say, Ian, it doesn't matter, you don't need it. That's totally fine. But I'll just say it to you. If I knew this was going to be a movie and I had a bit of money, all of the violence in the film would be practical.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it. Doesn't need to be. People are like, it doesn't need. That's just my.
That's just your preference. Like, yeah.
That's my preference. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So then I just, I sat in the chair, set it up, and then I had recorded lines, and I'd play the recording of the other version of me,
right. And
I would just pick an eye line and stare at it and then react to it. And then I would yell my lines back. Then I was like, man, why did I write so many like fighting scenes? Because you like have to be on the dialogue.
The choreographing of that with two of the same person.
It was wild. So then when I flipped it, I would try to look at the footage and pick the performances I thought I could use to edit. But then as when I was the religious Bradley and I was just going buck wild and doing all this, and I was like, oh, I definitely said stuff that I didn't say when I did the other Bradley. Oh man, how's this sort of gonna do? And I for like probably like 2 hours just filming that back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I need to edit this right now.
Yeah.
As soon as I shot it, I edited it until I fell asleep at the computer. Cause I was like, I don't want to change anything if this doesn't cut. Like, I don't want to like film this and then go to edit it next week.
Yeah.
And
totally different energy you take into the edit when you do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then because of the time constraint, I had edited that whole dialogue scene. And for people who haven't seen the movie, like half of it is just sort of a single slice of life guy going about, you know, and the second half with like this haunted house element. And then the second half, there's like a big dialogue scene that just happens. Yeah.
So is everything like all the little nooks and crannies, is everything in that house?
Yeah, everything. I brought nothing. Like I brought some lights and like my camera stuff. But that's it. I didn't bring any effects. That's why I was like, I didn't know I was going to make a movie. So literally everything you see, the beds that I stayed in were my nephews, that blanket with the figure coming out of it. That's their blanket on these mats that they have called the Nugget that they jump on. It's like padded mat the kids jump on. So I knew I wanted to do a scene where I trip and fall. Because I just wanted to land on this mat.
That's the wrestler inside you, isn't it?
That's the or the stuntman now, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't wrestle anymore, but just like little stuff like that. And then I was happy with the edit of the big dialogue scene.
Yeah.
But because of, like I said, the time constraint of the I had, you know, a lot of the heavy dialogue and story just got cut out, which was fine. And I saw what I had edited, and I was like, what if there was another one? And then that's when I, you know, so it all sort of was just happening in real time and shooting, editing.
My favorite look is the last character because it was, because we were talking about Collateral earlier.
Yeah.
Ruffalo's hair.
Yeah, that's
Mark like... Ruffalo's hair, man. That's so fucking much like, you look like Gordon Gekko, brother.
Yeah, well, it's again, I hadn't cut my hair in a while and I thought I can literally do this. And again, for people who haven't seen it, I play all these different characters. And if you have seen it, which you have, I would love to ask you, what is your interpretation of what the fuck is going on here with?
I think it's one person that's going through several stages of depression. Mm-hmm. And because of who's what's the way I wrote it to say it? Because of who's left, that person's fought off that depression and he's killed it off. And he's gone through those different stages before. That's how I see it.
That's that is literally what I was thinking. They're just the different, those are different versions of me in my depressive states, with the last one being
it was
a hopefulness for myself.
Because, you know, mental health in men, especially, and in the UK with a stiff upper lip and all of that.
That's why
I think it will do so well, because it's not spoken about enough. Men don't generally speak about their mental health enough. So,
it's crazy, because in such a time
like
today, where it is now spoken about, you know, again, we had talked about, you know, our age and when we grew up. And I mean, even when we were kids, you know, and you're from the UK, I'm from Canada, but that was, mental health was not a thing.
I remember, it doesn't exist.
Loving movies like we do, you know, mental health was like a shrink in a movie that an adult went to, but I didn't really understand why. Even I remember seeing Analyze This or Analyze That with Billy Crystal and Robert De Niro. Yeah. Even then, whenever that movie came out, like the late 90s, early 2000s, I don't even remember, I was still like, what's he going to see this guy? I knew it was a comedy, and okay, he's like, I thought it was like, oh, because it's like angry people go there to calm down, or, you know.
Yeah.
I had no idea. And you know, I look at even my family and you know, a lot of the traumas that, you know, our family has had specifically. And then I look at my parents and the traumas that they had, and it's like mental health was present through their whole upbringings, you know, in times where they never talked about it. You never had support like we had now. And then exactly as you had said, with men specifically, you know, but I think with everybody really, but yes, you're right. Men, and I didn't really think about that too in the UK, about how they sort of
it's such the perception of British people, especially since the 40s and what, you know, the whole of Europe went through. It was just a way of dealing with things. And now, like, I can fucking almost cry anything.
Yeah.
And like, it's, you know, it's, I'm like not afraid to, you know, like, I'm honest with my wife and how open I was. And we talked about when I came out of hospital, for instance, when I COVID pneumonia and the first week I came out, we tried to go into this kind of Chinese supermarket, which I love. They have these Buddha beers. They've got food from all over the world. I literally felt like I was hitting a brick wall when I tried to go in the shop, because the aisles were really tight.
Yeah.
And I couldn't go in, and we had an argument. We went home, and then I burst into tears. And then my wife, you know, burst into tears as well. And that was because I hadn't fully understood what she went through as a person. I think she didn't know anything what was going on in the hospital, because no word, because it was so rife. And she thought I was going to die. I accepted I was going to die in hospital, but I didn't tell her that.
Yeah.
So it was like, and the consequence of being so emotionally available now and open is my fuse is about this short.
Well, it really illuminates, you know, and I think when you start, you know, if you could identify, you know, and I didn't ask for help for a long, long time, you know, and if you can, you know, and I mean, I had a really close friend, last September take his own life. And, you know, it really changed my life for, like, I mean, you know, my dad passed away and cancer and that fucking you know, and that was traumatic and disease and it's horrible, but, you know, a suicide, it's just not something I ever thought about, you know, and had to think about and process. And it just, you know, and then, you know, it happened, and people would reach out and they'd be like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, you know, yeah, my mom's so-and-so best friend, or, and you start hearing all these other stories and you think, my goodness, this is, you know, this is so much more common than I ever even could have imagined, you know?
And, yeah, absolutely.
And it just, yeah, it just, it really changed sort of everything, you know? And I had always, as I said, I was always been very keen to speak about mental health and my mental health, which I've been very self-aware of, has been existent for a lot of years now. And, you know, I did do a project, I think in 2018, about my, you know, my mental health as well, with the Polly. I don't know if you ever saw that one. With the
I watched everything on the website. Yeah,
a little toy. Yeah. Pretty dark and takes a very depressing turn at the end. And then after that had happened, I thought, there needs to be more communication about this. And I love, you know, I did not set out to make a movie about mental health. Even though, yes, it's so blatant in it, but, you know, I didn't realize it, how people would take it. And even your interpretation of the Bradleys, like, that's exactly what it was, because that's literally how I've felt sort of metaphorically at different stages of it, you know? And so it's like wild that something that literally has happened to me, you can sort of identify with in a way. And, you know, I think that,
I'll give you an example. This is a really unusual link to Star Trek, and we'll get to that.
Oh yes,
but when, like, I think it was Call of Duty, it was one of those games, Modern Warfare 2 came out, and I bought it, and I was living at home and early 30s, and it was like, I'm still fucking it. I went, you know, university was great, have this job, work, living at home.
Yeah.
Awful situation. And then when I was playing it, I went through a very early midlife crisis.
Okay.
About my own mortality. And then I was like, right, I've got to step away from this. All this killing on this. I still, you know, I love entertainment, love games and all that.
Sure.
I had to step away from it. And it was like, oh my God, the process. Like, I really started to turn inward and think, you know, drink too much and all of that.
Yeah.
And then, because I'm a huge Star Trek fan, my wife and I, we watched all of it apart from Strange New Worlds and Discovery newest season.
Okay.
And when we watched Star Trek Generations, you know, seventh film, and they were talking about Malcolm McDowell's character. I can't remember his character now, I should know it. He's talking about death being a predator, it's pursuing you. But then Picard talks about how death is a companion. It helps you reflect on life and how it helps you remember things throughout your life. When I watched that, I was like, wow, this is helping me process where my head was at.
Yeah.
I
love whatever the things, whatever they are that allow you to, you know, whatever art in whatever capacity that speaks to you. And, you know, I think that's really why Star Trek specifically, you know, one of the main things outside of the amazing characters and, you know, the futuristic, you know, lore and all that, but is like the human element through that entire show, through that entire series, you know, I will be honest with you, I am a Star Wars guy.
It's all good. It's all gravy, man.
And then when I got the audition,
you were the biggest Star Trek fan in the world, right?
Yeah. Well, when I got the audition, which then I, when I booked it, found out that it was a Star Trek show. Of course, I mean, you know, I loved it. I saw all the movies in the theater with my dad. You know, we watched.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, it means so much. It means so much.
Years of it, right?
Yeah.
Like, but I was more of a Star Wars movie guy. I just didn't really watch really a lot of.
It's the characters and certain things connected with you in the stronger.
But it was, you know, and it's. So it was, you know, so getting it, it's still like what an incredible thing to be a part of, and, you know, it's a sort of understanding, you know, that world a lot more. You know, it's like reading a lot of people on forums and message boards, you know, talking about how that show or those characters specifically helped to impact their life, change their life, you know, how these epiphanies that they had about themselves through watching this show, this, you know, entertainment, yeah. which is like incredible.
Join myself and Ian Rayburn next week as we continue to talk about Star Trek, filmmaking, and all things horror. All right, bye-bye.